Welcome to the MJA podcast, where today we have something a little different for you. On the 17th of November, the MJA hosted a webinar entitled, How to Save Lives in the First Few Days of COVID-19 Symptoms. There were so many questions from the audience that we didn't have time to get to them all. So, we've invited back the two presenters of the webinar to spend some time answering the backlog of questions about the early treatment of COVID-19.
It is worth considering if you are looking after a practice with a lot of heavily immunosuppressed patients that you in advance do an antibody level to see their response to vaccination and either derive some assurance or have a treatment plan for those individuals if they go on to develop COVID.
That was Adjunct Associate Professor James Branley, an infectious diseases physician and microbiologist currently heading the Department of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases at Nepean Hospital, west of Sydney. Associate Professor Branley has extensive experience in the treatment and management of mild, moderate, and severe COVID-19.
There is very, very good evidence that good control of chronic illness is protective in terms of doing badly with COVID. Minimising those risks as much as possible is incredibly important.
That was Associate Professor Lucy Morgan, a respiratory physician at Concord and Nepean Hospitals, with extensive experience in the management of patients with severe COVID-19 illness. She is also a director of the Lung Foundation of Australia. James and Lucy are our special guests today.
So there are obviously quite a lot of unanswered questions, and there seem to be a few themes. One that jumped out at me was the use of sidrofumab vaccinated people. James, do you want to talk about that and what we can tell people about when and when not to do that?
Yeah, sure, Kate, thanks. Look, I think immunity to COVID is still an area we need to understand much better, and not that I need to remind the audience of this, but there are basically two sorts of immunity. There's humoral immunity, where you make an antibody, and that's measurable today. That's something we can do currently and understand. There's also cell-mediated immunity that's much more difficult to measure. It's not impossible to measure that, and I think the future will be that we start to measure both humoral immunity and cell-mediated immunity to this disease, particularly in target populations. But at this stage, we're not at that point yet. But what we do know is there's a group of those immunosuppressed patients that I talked about in the webinar that really don't mount a good humoral immune response. And I think given that we are giving an antibody, we are replacing that humoral immune response. And so I think we can actually use laboratory testing to determine who and when should potentially at risk of getting disease and getting severe disease because they haven't mounted a good humoral response to vaccination. Now, one of the questions deals with at what level do you ascribe humoral immunity? And I think that's also great unknown. We do know that, and we've measured a lot of response to natural infection, and most humoral immunity is measured in doubling dilutions, so 10, 20, 40, 80, 160. Mm-hmm. And we do know that many of the people who've had infections have antibodies that are over 1,000. 1,280 is a significant antibody level. I know that my own immunity after two doses of Pfizer was 160. And so it appears that really quite low levels of antibody protective, and we know that on a population basis that people who are vaccinated are protected by vaccine, and many of those will have antibody levels that are in the double digits or in the early triple digits, and those people still appear to be protected. So I guess what we're trying to identify is people who have really low or no antibody response to vaccine. From our experience, we've seen absolutely zero antibody produced in people like renal transplants who are on immunosuppression, cancer patients on heavy chemotherapy. Many of these patients will produce nothing. And a third vaccine, although we don't exactly know, but it's quite likely that the third vaccine in those patients won't actually do much more than the first two vaccines did.
Right.
So these are an excellent target group for sotrovimab therapy. And I think we are going to be in a position where we're just going to have to guess this for the moment because we won't get the antibody levels back in time. But it is worth considering if you are looking after a practice with a lot of heavily immunosuppressed patients that you in advance do an antibody level to see their response to vaccination and either derive some assurance or have a treatment plan for those individuals if they go on to develop COVID.
That treatment plan might be as simple as saying to yourself and to your patient, you know what, you are probably incompletely vaccinated. So even if you don't measure the levels, just saying to yourself and to the patient, I identify you as being at risk of being incompletely vaccinated. So if you get COVID, let me know, and then the next step is we will organise for you to be referred quickly to somewhere where you could get early treatment with sotrovimab. Yeah. So even if it's that iterative process or that thought process of identifying a patient at risk for being incompletely vaccinated, even if it's not a matter of measuring the levels, although in a perfect world, we could actually measure those levels. I think for the GP, for the practical sense of from the GP's point of view, it's that thought process. This patient is at risk of being incompletely vaccinated and therefore at risk of developing severe disease from COVID. So saying to the patient, if you get COVID, let me know straight away and then we'll do this. The other point I'd make about the vaccine, about sotrovimab in patients who have been vaccinated, we're scientists and we've got to remember that the science on which we're basing these medical decisions did not include patients who were completely vaccinated, but for a very different reason. The trial data was performed at a time when community vaccination rates were not as high as they are now, and when actually none of the vaccines had FDA approval. So the clinical trial was done in patients who were on something that was called an investigational or a product. They were excluded from the trial because they were on an investigational product. And I think that's really important to remember. It's not that we think bad things will happen to patients who've been double vaxxed if they get sotrovimab, that the trial was done in patients who didn't have double vaccination.
One of the challenges, though, and this has been a very real issue, has been the way the guidelines are written currently, you're actually using the drug off-label if you give it to a fully vaccinated patient. Right. That doesn't faze, you know, experienced clinicians who know what they're doing and are prepared to explain that to the patient cohort. But for the broader medical population, use of off-label things and not using drugs in accordance with the recommended becomes problematic. One of the questions I have is, are we going to change the definition of fully vaccinated to 3 vaccines rather than 2 vaccines, in which case suddenly a whole lot of patients become eligible for the drug again?
Can you see a day, James, when we will be testing antibody levels before booster shots, for example?
Yes, I can see that being done, certainly from a research perspective, to define I think we need to define the failure point and actually understand what the failure point is. And I don't think we'll do this for every patient. We will assume clearly 90% of people who get vaccines really get a huge benefit from them. But we will define small cohorts of patients that are at risk of significant vaccine failure, I think, in the future.
There was a question I noted from somebody suggesting that the TGA is moving too slowly in terms of FDA approval, CDC approval, European approval, etc. Is there an argument that the TGA does need to move a little faster on these drugs?
I don't think it's a perfect system, but it probably is the best we've got. What I think the question was tapping into, both the FDA in America and CE in Europe are really robust processes. Okay. And I think there is more opportunity for us as a small nation to accept well-done studies from overseas as being similar to our environment. Now, they're not identical, and it is worth repeating those studies, but I do wonder in a national crisis, in a pandemic, whether there's an opportunity to have even more fast-tracking of process so that we get to a point quicker. And, you know, vaccine introduction was a very good example of where we could have gone perhaps a little faster. I note there are some questions about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, and I guess right at the start of the pandemic, you know, I was quite keen to launch into using whatever we could, because really we had nothing. So in those first few months of March and April 2020, we had veterinary practitioners telling us that for coronaviruses they used hydroxychloroquine, and in vitro scientists telling us that if you put enough ivermectin on coronavirus, you would kill it. And it was very attractive and we had nothing else at that stage.
Yes.
Now, our national process was very strong at saying you shouldn't use experimental things unless you're using them as part of a trial. And as a clinician, that's very frustrating. You want to dive into using whatever you can, and because you are seeing people get very unwell and die, and that is frustrating. I know from my own personal experience, I was using some azithromycin early on because of its anti-inflammatory properties, and maybe that would help with cytokine storm, since gone on to be effectively disproven as a useful agent. I was also using vitamin D, and once again, does that have an immune regulating function? I think those things were essentially okay because their side effect profile is such that I was unlikely to be doing harm.
Yeah. That's right. It's the first do no harm and we might do some good, as opposed to, and at the time, the level of evidence for things that did work was remarkably thin. But since then, we've had national and international adaptive phase trials that have tested a whole lot of things and proven lack of efficacy for us. Mm-hmm. And yes. We've got some signals around real danger and harm that came out of some other things. And they've been robustly studied in extraordinarily short time. And I think we have a much clearer recipe book of ingredients that make for safe treatment profiles, which we just didn't have. And I think ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and fishbowl cleaner fall into the group where there is evidence of harm and no evidence of benefit.
I think that's right. I mean, these are toxic drugs. Hydroxychloroquine in particular can be very cardiotoxic, neurotoxic, and ivermectin has toxicity as well. And exposing patients to those toxicities without good reason is not to be recommended in any way. I think the question dealt with the combination of ivermectin, doxycycline, and hydroxychloroquine. And I think if you combine three things that don't work, I don't see the logic in three non-effective drugs working where one hasn't.
Have you looked at the data of fluoxetine, James?
I was just looking at that today, and it's intriguing, and there may be a role for it. That study was 27th of October, so it's fairly recent.
What's the usual use for fluoxetine?
Fluoxetine's an antidepressant.
And yeah, it's an SSRI, and I think it's intriguing. This, like budesonide, has come out of the observations that people haven't presented as commonly in that. I think the relative risk ratio is 0.68, but interestingly, there was still a significant mortality in the fluvoxetine group. I think that just bodes a note of caution, because it may be that it's a drug that might have minor activity, and 12 or 18 months ago it might have been great, but I think when you've got much more effective options, it's unlikely to be something we use a lot of. The data on steroids is also interesting. Inhaled steroids, may have a role. Certainly anecdotally, I can say that we have had really, really sick asthmatics come into hospital who've been taking an inhaled puffer. So it certainly doesn't completely prevent the disease. And the other thing to mention is that early use of steroids in a highly viral phase of the disease may not be the best thing to do from first principles. And certainly in India, there's been a lot of cases of mucor secondary infection related to overuse of steroids.
It's a very, very clear signal that in COVID pneumonitis, the use of steroids before people are hypoxemic is associated with harm. Once they're breathless, have chest x-ray abnormalities and have hypoxemia, then the risk-benefit balance definitely tips in favour of steroids. But there is no evidence to suggest that steroids orally, systemic steroids used before the need, before that hypoxemia is a safe thing to do or a necessary thing to do. But I would just come back to the inhaled steroids comment as a respiratory physician, that there is very, very good evidence that good control of chronic illness is protective in terms of doing badly with COVID. Okay.
Yes.
So the patient with asthma whose asthma is well controlled with inhaled budesonide should make sure that they keep up their maintenance good control. the patient with COPD or pulmonary fibrosis or bronchiectasis who has a management plan that involves compliant use, adherent use of inhaled medications or oral medications, should make sure that they keep up all their treatments so that they're stable and get vaccinated against all vaccine-preventable illnesses, including COVID-19, in order to minimise their risk of doing badly if they catch COVID. Part of that is also around hand hygiene, around avoiding, you know, minimizing their risk of catching the virus. And that has included up until now some degree of physical isolation and social connectedness. There's no doubt that keeping control of chronic diseases, you know, diabetes, absolutely. Poor glycemic control is associated with really bad outcomes for patients that catch COVID. Having a very high BMI and being obese, having renal failure, especially patients dialyzing, these are all risk factors for doing badly if you catch COVID. Minimizing those risks as much as possible is incredibly important. Whether or not the budesonide actually has a specific role to play in treating COVID is a little bit hard to tease out.
One of the things that really stood out for me on Wednesday night in your presentations was the importance of obesity. Do we know what the mechanism is in terms of obese patients and COVID?
It's almost certainly multifactorial. There may well be something in cytokine metabolism, glycemic metabolism.
My own theory is that inflammation is playing a role here. And we do know from gut microbiome studies that obese patients have a different gut microbiome and it's very pro-inflammatory. And I suspect that there are multiple factors in obesity where the immune system is primed to be much more inflammatory. And we always think about things like joint disease in obese patients as being because they're carrying weight and actually destroying the joint, but it may well be that they're much more pro-inflammatory and joints are more likely to get inflamed. So when the virus comes along into this group of patients, they, you know, their lungs are primed by diet, by microbiome, just by the presence of a lot of fat-laden cells to be very reactive, bearing in mind that a lot of the pro-inflammatory markers are in lipid metabolism type pathways and connections in that sense. But we certainly lost one super obese patient for mechanical reasons, and that was the inability to keep an airway in somebody who lost their endotracheal tube and lost their airway. So the mechanical issues related to somebody who's 250 kilos is really problematic.
Is there a baseline BMI that GPs should be having a red flag about?
So 30 is the one that's quoted, but if you look in the international literature around sotrovimab talks about 25 as well. So they're the two that are listed. 25 is a challenge for all of us, I think. But I do think it, particularly as we get heavier, as we get older, you know, I had a woman that I tried to persuade to have sotrovimab, and she eventually did. She was day three, and she was 29.9 BMI, and she was 54 years old, and both of those are technically outside the requirements, but they're both counts. They're right on the edge, you know, being older than 55's the cutoff, and being greater than 30 BMI. Yeah.
So, Lucy, if I'm a GP monitoring a COVID patient at home, what sort of oxygen sats do I need to see before I start going, you need to go to hospital now?
There's two different categories that I just sort of separate out. I'd think about those patients who've got chronic lung disease to start with and those that don't. Yep. Because if you've got chronic lung disease, your normal resting saturations might be sort of 95 or so, and you're feeling otherwise well, then you're not going to overreact at sats of 94. However, if your normal resting sats are much higher than that, 96, 97, 98, and then suddenly you've got sats of 94 or less and you're breathless, then that's a significant change. I've been talking to my junior colleagues about a construct of the natural tempo or the river, the story of natural COVID illness, of imagining the COVID illness as being a bit like a wild river, where there are parts of the river that can be wide and relatively shallow, where the water doesn't run that fast, where the sun shines and you can hear magpies in the trees. And early in the COVID illness, it's a bit like walking in that river. You can still walk quite well. You can certainly breathe. You might have some symptoms, but the river's wide and you can walk. But as you go through the COVID illness, sometime around about, you know, in my experience, it's around about day 7 or day 8 or day 9 or day 10, in those middle days, after a week or so of symptoms. It's like walking in deeper water. The water gets faster and colder, and there are tree stumps and rocks and holes in the river. And so having an understanding of that kind of scene at least raises the idea that these are the risk days, when you can fall in a hole or into the rapids pretty quickly, and that once you're starting to get into the deeper water, things will likely progress very quickly. And so the day of presentation with the severe symptoms really does predict what the path or the river's like over the next few days. And I think for the GP to have just that kind of idea, to be able to say the patient's had symptoms from this day, to have a day one, to know that, okay, they're at day three, they've got mild symptoms, no hypoxemia, they're within 5 days of symptom onset, and we know they're positive, we should get them early treatment, get them onto sotrovimab if we can.
Yeah.
If, however, they're day 10, they're much further down the track and they're much more symptomatic, and especially if they're hypoxic, they need to be in hospital because the river ahead is deep and cold and there's a waterfall coming.
The 17th November webinar, How to Save Lives in the First Few Days of COVID-19 Symptoms, and this podcast were sponsored by GlaxoSmithKline Australia Proprietary Limited through an unrestricted medical grant. Through this grant, the event's host, AMCO, at its masthead, the Medical Journal of Australia, maintain complete editorial control over the agenda, speaker selection and content. Our guests are James Branley and Lucy Morgan, who have been treating patients with COVID-19 at Nepean Hospital in New South Wales since the start of the pandemic. In the show notes for this podcast, you will find links to the full video of the webinar and links to some useful resources recommended by our guests for GPs and other health practitioners engaged in monitoring and care of patients with COVID-19. If you are enjoying this podcast, feel free to seek out the MJA's full library of episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are free to access. You can also subscribe to our feed through Spotify, Podomatic, Apple Music, Amazon Music, and Audible.
I think I agree absolutely, Lucy. And you know, I think the day number is really important. It's a really good starting point. I think we do monitor the oxygen saturations from day one at home, and in the early days, we regarded a saturation of 92 or less as being the marker for hospitalisation. The latest guidelines have tended to suggest anything less than 95 is your trigger for hospitalisation. So most of the primary care guidelines are suggesting less than 95. Now, there's a few tricks to that. You don't always get a good saturation on difficult patients. You don't always get a good saturation on children. And you can probably, because children, you know, we've looked after a lot of children with this disease as well, and they don't tend to get in trouble as much, and their saturations can be bouncing around all over the place, and you know, you're not getting accurate measurement of them.
Even the GP's worried, and they're getting sats that are low. It's a safe thing. It's a safe thing to do to, you know, to get them assessed in the hospital.
Children often have a tachycardia being the more worrying ob that worries you. But the other thing we do see in adults, and I'd really emphasise what Lucy was saying, is that when you're getting into those middle days, we sometimes just get transient DSATs. And if you're sitting on day 7 or 8 and you suddenly have a dip in your sats, it seems to be a harbinger that you're going to have hypoxia, sustained hypoxia, coming down the line. So it is worth, in primary care, if you're noticing some DSATs, get them in, consider pulmonary embolus, obviously, and consider observing them much more closely in hospital at that point.
there were a lot of questions from your audience on Wednesday night about pregnant women and when and if and how they should get on to early treatment. So what's the general view from you both about that?
We've treated about 70 pregnant women with COVID, and there are a range of physiological and immunological differences in pregnant women that need consideration. And there's a lot of, importantly, social issues around maintaining connection with family, because COVID is a family disease and you often have mum and three kids all with the virus. And if that mum has a sick partner or has, you know, is a single mum, then you need a strategy around family care and sometimes hospitalised family care, and that's manageable.
We
had a beautiful family-friendly ward where we had both paediatricians and adult physicians combining to look after mum and bub and sometimes dad. And sometimes one of the family members was in intensive care, and so there's a lot of extreme emotional overlay in that. But getting back to the data is that pregnant women can be vaccinated, firstly.
Yes.
And they can be vaccinated at any stage in their pregnancy, and there is no signal of harm from vaccination. So we really need to be strongly encouraging our pregnant women not to wait and to get vaccinated. And you might have noticed that health is a female predominant workforce, and the requirement is that all health practitioners be vaccinated in New South Wales, certainly, and
yes,
in many other states. And, you know, that acknowledges the fact that pregnant nurses are going to need to get vaccinated and pregnant doctors are going to need to get vaccinated. It's not an exemption.
And doctors and nurses who want to become pregnant are going to need to be vaccinated.
Yeah.
It was a really difficult to manage thread at one point of the vaccine being associated with impaired fertility or impaired capacity.
Still going
to
on, trust me.
And that was really problematic or really difficult for us to manage.
And it's just fake news.
And it's just fake news. But so for the GP who's seeing patients who want to become pregnant, they can categorically reassure their patients that there is no evidence of reduced fertility. But I tell you what, there's nothing that will impair your fertility like getting severe COVID and dying, and nothing that will impair your ability to deliver a healthy baby like having severe COVID. We've had some experience of managing both sotrovimab, but also managing advanced pregnancies and deliveries of mums who had really bad COVID, who were really sick. And
so it's important to, when we get into treating COVID in pregnant women, it's important to go back to the sotrovimab literature, and really the side effect profile of sotrovimab is the same as placebo. In fact, I think numerically placebo was worse than sotrovimab. So what it appears is that you, not statistically, but numerically, it really appears that this is a very safe drug. And pregnant women, in my experience, at least 20% of them have been resistant to the idea of having this drug in pregnancy. And there is a bunch of questions in their mind, and there's a bunch of research they've done on the internet, and it tells them that this is an experimental drug and it's the doctors experimenting on them. The counter argument to that is that we've treated infectious diseases for many years, and even before we had antibiotics and antivirals, we had antibodies that we used to treat it. So this is an old-fashioned disease. We've put high-tech engineering, bioengineering into developing monoclonals, but it's old-fashioned thinking. You develop an antibody against a virus, and that's always been our gold standard of treatment, and it's the same way that vaccine works. So there is nothing new in giving an antibody for an infectious disease. The second thing is that there hasn't been a signal of harm to any fetuses from the use of these drugs. And the third thing is that they've even taken that one step further and essentially had a microarray of fetal tissue and exposed the sotrovimab to an array of fetal tissue. And there is no adverse binding of sotrovimab to fetal tissue. So at a very basic science level, there's good reason to suggest that this is incredibly safe in pregnancy. And, you know, I have used it in first trimester in patients with risk factors, and I would continue to do that if there is a good reason for that woman to have sotrovimab, and it doesn't seem to be an issue. So clear communication of that's really important. and then really having a very acute radar for the pregnant woman becoming unwell, because particularly in the second and third trimesters, pregnant women can really deteriorate very, very rapidly. And we've seen deteriorations not only from COVID, but from mechanical reasons, and not only from that, but from bacterial infection and pulmonary embolus in that setting. Okay. The basic rule, we established a combined infectious diseases ONG unit where we had combined care of inpatient pregnant women. And our ONG colleagues tell us that essentially from the baby's point of view, you do everything to keep mum well and you allow baby to cook through to at least 34 weeks. And before that, you shouldn't be electively delivering the baby unless mum's really in significant trouble. Yep. The ANZ College of ONG has really good guidelines on this, and it's a really good reference resource. Very, very sensible committee guidelines.
Just one other thing. It's just really about the experience of monoclonal antibodies for pregnant women in other diseases. And that is, so in severe asthma, we've got quite a big body of evidence of very safe application of monoclonal antibody therapy for severe asthma in pregnant women. So things like omalizumab and mepolizumab used for severe asthma, they're monoclonal antibodies and they're safely administered to patients who have very severe asthma and are pregnant without any consequence. So just another model of this sort of drug. It's not chemotherapy. It's not immunosuppressive therapy. It's monoclonal antibody therapy.
And it's about rapid antigen testing. What role can that play in terms of monitoring and knowing when a patient needs to get moving on the treatment?
Good question, Kate. Rapid antigen testing is plagued with some problems, I guess. It has both false positives and false negatives, and they need to be considered. Where it performs well is when it's done on consecutive days and there's more than one rapid antigen test done. So two or three rapid antigen tests really do help define negative patients much better. It will miss low-level positivity from PCR. So PCR, if you look at a group of positive patients with PCR, you will pick up more of the positives with PCR than you will with rapid antigen testing. But what you're actually picking up with the rapid antigen tests is the more infectious and often the earlier illness rather than late disease or non-infectious disease or even old disease. We're seeing an emerging problem with patients who've had COVID remaining test positive with PCR, and rapid antigen is less likely to be positive in that setting. So there may be circumstances where rapid antigen performs to purpose, but the limitations of rapid antigen really need to be considered. I think in terms of defining and identifying patients who are positive early, there's likely to be a role, and that may well be self-diagnosis. There was some questions from rural practitioners in rural Victoria and also practitioners in northern Victoria. And I just want to say that both of those comments sound to me like you're exactly on the right track with what you're doing. I think you're doing an important job. You're doing good work monitoring people. Yes, it is cost effective to monitor patients with oxygen sats at home and to watch these patients closely and pick the patients that are going to need hospitalisation, because if you hospitalise them, you will help prevent them dying or becoming very unwell. So well done. And the person in northern Victoria, northern Melbourne, who is dealing with a lot of cases of sotrovimab, I agree with you entirely. It is challenging to get people diagnosed in 5 days and get them treated in that time frame. Now, I must confess, we have been a little bit liberal with the rules here and have used sotrovimab for patients who are first presentation hospitalizations, only just starting their oxygen requirement. And I think if you look at the sotrovimab data, there's concern about using it when somebody's ventilated or when they're on really non-invasive ventilation or the higher forms of oxygen therapy. But the first time they present, I've used it on numerous occasions in patients who maybe are day 5, 6, 7, but they are starting to become hypoxic. And I've seen patients in that category turn around. Not all of them, clearly,
yeah.
But no, I have seen... That.
And I think that's a contrast to what I was saying about the steroids. So steroids before you're hypoxic really causes more harm than good. Sotrovimab at the tipping point of hypoxemia is definitely still beneficial rather than not. It's not useful at day 12 when you're in ICU with diffuse ARDS. But in that early time, I agree with James about that. We've used it very successfully. And then there are some particular circumstances where it's particularly been great. And some of those patients who've got chronic chronic diseases, COPD, renal failure, bad diabetes, bad sleep apnea, and they may well have borderline impaired gas exchange at the best of times. So a tiny bit of a dip. It's just telling you that they're early on in their symptoms. And we've had some fantastic responses in those patient groups, especially in the hospital acquired setting. We've been able to put out spot fires in hospital nosocomial acquisition of COVID.
Yeah, that's right. It's really useful
and
in that setting.
The nursing home, the aged care facilities is another potential opportunity, I think, for people to be getting it even if they are a bit hypoxemic.
Potentially even if they're vaccinated in that setting.
Yeah.
I think it's a group you want to think about using it even if you've got a vaccinated patient in that. One of the concepts there is the number of days. You know, we regard it as absolute day one to day five. In my experience, they're at least half the patients, there's plus or minus two in that equation. So you can say, look, they could be on day five or they could be on day seven. And I think if we are really rigid in our thinking, what I've encouraged my team to do is to bias it towards using sotrovimab rather than bias it the other way. That's because you're dealing with a really low toxicity drug and the chances of you doing harm are small. There is a theoretical chance you'll do harm in the intubated patient in that, you know, there's a theoretical concern you'll make cytokine storm worse at that stage. But really at that crossover time, I would encourage people to regard it as day five, plus or minus two or three, and err on that side. I've also used it in compassionate grounds. We have had patients who have been clearly dying when they've been diagnosed and their time frame has been uncertain and we've thought it may well not help and some of those patients have died, but I think it's been on compassionate grounds in heavily immunosuppressed patients where there might be a benefit.
Two comments. One is that around the issue of day five or day or plus or minus two, there's a very big body of data out of the Middle East where they used it up to day 10, thousands and thousands and thousands, 20,000 doses given before day 10 with extremely good outcomes. They just had a different model of care and they had a day 10 cutoff. It's just not what we've been doing in Australia, but lots of good data to suggest it is very safe to use it even up to day 10 if they're not profoundly hypoxic at that time. The second thing to say was there's some emerging data that it may be as efficacious given intramuscularly. And obviously at the moment, that's not what we're doing, but given how quickly things have moved in this space, within a period of time, it may well be that gives us another option and will not, of course, require the 24-hour, the infusion, that the single-dose infusion that we've been giving. And that might change the patterns of care or the model of care of giving this drug. I was just going to give an anecdote of using sotrovimab in a patient who was dying of something else, and so that we could get the patient to a place where they could be in the care of their family, absolutely for compassionate reasons, so that they could spend their last days in the care of their family rather than die alone in hospital.
In terms of settings, I mean, does sotrovimab have to be infused in a hospital setting? Aged care homes, for example, is there a possibility of that?
Yeah, look, there's a possibility. During the webinar the other night, I ran through some criteria that need to be sort of addressed in terms of identifying where you can do it. And look, I know there was an article from the ACT where one of my colleagues is giving it in a caravan type setting. It's mobile. And I think what you want is you want competent nurses who can establish an IV. You want them to be anaphylaxis trained because that's your main risk factor. You want to have an escalation pathway if a patient becomes unwell. So, you know, is that call an ambulance or is it how are you going to handle an anaphylaxis in that setting? You also want to have it safe from an infection control setting because you're dealing with red patients. So your staff and the community need to be protected in that equation. Now, most people find that's easily done in a modified hospital setting, and that's what most people have done, but it's not universal. People have done it in different ways and set up.
Our colleagues in Western New South Wales have set up some given doses, you know, in community, you know, in a clinic setting, you know, a community health centre in the same place that they might do a diabetes clinic.
It's really about keeping everyone safe in the equation. So keeping the patient safe, keeping the community safe, keeping the staff safe. And you, as long as you manage to have a model that does all of those things, I think you can do it in numerous different ways.
Is there enough of the stuff about? Is supply good?
Well, look, you know, we've used in the hundreds. So, and Victoria have used in the hundreds. Mm. The initial order was 7,700. So I don't think we've come under supply pressure as yet. I think one of the intriguing things is going to be how it pans out with the oral agents coming online. So when molnupiravir and Paxlovid and, you know, some of the other drugs, or also Regen-Cov, which is also about to probably be licensed, there are competitors in this space for doing the same thing. And what we are going to need to do is develop ideas in our head about which one of these strategies we're going to use for individual patients.
Thank you both for your time.
Kate, it's been lovely to chat. I'm happy to do it again.
Likewise.
The other thing that if I got a chance to, I'd spruik for the GP's sake is the wide range of resources available to help them with decisions about how to talk to their patients about sticky things like vaccinations and early treatment. The Lung Foundation of Australia has a set of links for doctors and a set of which resources for doctors and a set of resources for doctors to give to their patients. There's a wide list or a long list of really good resources produced by various organisations. James has already mentioned the College of ONG. The ACI documents around the treatment of the sick patient in hospital and the patient needing oxygen support are good documents.
The two from me are the Living Guidelines and the second one, from a public health perspective, and probably 50% of the questions that come to me have a public health type flavour or an infection control flavour. And the SONG, which is the System of National Guidelines, is really, you know, they're the two main documents we use on a daily basis.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.